BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. Amelia Dyer, the serial killer of children. We don't even know how many of them.
I told them that after I got a baby, something seemed to say in my ears, get rid of it. And when I put the tape around his neck and I saw the poor little thing struggle, I did not feel what I'd done.
Mary Ann Cotton, the woman who tried to get on in life by killing 3 out of 4 of her husbands for the insurance.
I wish to consult with you about getting me a petition for my life to be spared.
Hannah Mary Tabbs, a very cool customer from the States, who boarded a train with the victim's torso in her bag.
Wilson pointed to the body of Gaines and said, if you will take that part, I'll take all the rest.
And Esther Lack, short of money, terribly ill, driven by desperation to kill her own babies.
I thought it better to do what I did, because I thought my children would be safer to be in heaven than starving about the streets.
The one thing they all have in common is that they were all brought to justice for murder. We've been looking afresh at these shocking murders from over 100 years ago, all of them committed by women. And I want to use these crimes to learn about Victorian society, to discover why these women tackled the problems they faced in such an extraordinary way. If you've been following the podcasts, then you'll know that we've dug into the motives and the misconceptions surrounding each of our murderesses. If you haven't, well, this is your spoiler alert. You might want to press stop and catch up before you go on. In this episode, we delve a little deeper into the world in which these women lived. We're talking about who decides what a crime is, how these murderesses were seen. We're going to discuss the role experts played in bringing them to justice, and we'll reflect on how much, or how little, the problems faced by Victorian women have been solved. And once again, I'm joined by our in-house historian, Dr. Rosalind Crone from the Open University, our oracle on all things Victorian. Hi there, Ros.
Hi, Lucy. Well, last time we met to discuss our lady killers, we had 4 women who mostly got away with it. And today, I think it's fair to say that all our women were quite clearly guilty.
Good to get that straight. We're talking about the bad uns today. I'm looking forward to it. Now, Ros, they may all have been found guilty of murder, but all of these 4 women were shaped by their environment. Can you tell me a bit about the circumstances that led them to do the crimes that they did?
Sure. Well, like the cases we looked at in our previous discussion, each of these murders continues to be connected with the domestic sphere. Okay, so Lack kills her children, Dyer kills other people's children who have been put into her care, Cotton kills those in her personal life, husbands, lovers, children, her mother, Tabbs kills her lover. But whereas in the previous discussion episode, all the murders happened within the context of high or affluent society, this set of murderers, much lower down the social spectrum, these were women who lived on the edge. They had much more precarious lives. And so there was a real focus on survival.
But all the more challenging and interesting to research, right?
As an historian, absolutely. So if we look at Esther Lack, now she's very interesting, living in overcrowded accommodation in an alleyway on Bankside in London. She's got a large family. Her husband is working several jobs. She has many children, but half of them die when they're very, very young. And she has ill health. And all of this took its toll. And this was actually recognised by the medical men who wanted to explain the existence of puerperal insanity, which they said led her to commit the terrible murders that she did.
So we're talking about what today might be called postpartum psychosis. But what a difficult life. So much is stacked against her, isn't it? Poor Esther. What about Amelia Dyer?
Oh, Amelia Dyer, exceptional in scale in terms of the number of murders committed, but there were many dubious, even murderous baby farmers at this time, and they were providing a service in Victorian Britain to deal with unwanted children, women who had babies out of wedlock and did not have supportive families and had little choice but to find childcare, aka a baby farmer. And the money they provided to those baby farmers is just not enough to keep a child alive.
What I found particularly chilling when we investigated this case is your saying that although Amelia Dyer was caught, she was only doing something that seemed almost natural to the Victorian people, and you're pretty sure that other baby farmers were doing the same thing.
We know there were other baby farmers doing the same thing who were murderers because they too were brought to justice.
And in a capitalist society, I guess that this is what happens. Money speaks. If there's no money, then the problem has to be solved by some other and very brutal means. It's very depressing to think about. And what about over in the States? Hannah Mary Tabbs, a violent woman, but born into a violent slave-owning society. She's lived through a civil war. It sort of makes sense to me that she herself turns to violence in order to protect herself and her space. Dr. Callie Gross, who's researched Tabbs's life, explains the violence that both the enslaved and those freed from slavery would face in 19th century America.
All Black folks at this time are incredibly vulnerable to racist violence and the tyranny of white supremacy. And so for the enslaved, this is beatings, being starved, forced breeding, rape, sexual violence. All of these things are fairly prevalent and common experiences for enslaved populations. Even if there are distinctions between who's free and who is enslaved, their lives are still very much entangled. So it would be entirely possible for someone who is free to nonetheless have witnessed those kinds of violent atrocities if they themselves had not experienced them.
And Mary Ann Cotton, another serial killer, was.
She was born into a grim and a hard life in the northeast coalfields. And this murderess really brings female dependence on men into sharp relief. She needs a husband who will provide, and she's quite ambitious about what he might provide. She goes about removing obstacles that come in her way. Husbands who don't meet expectations, children and stepchildren who might get in the way of new relationships, while she's also making a little bit extra from the life insurance scheme she puts on them. And basically, this is the inability of women to earn enough to support themselves and their families.
This is a dark, dark episode full of dark stories, but may I make a shocking confession? I have a sneaking bit of admiration for the entrepreneurship of Mary Ann Cotton. This is a woman who killed 75% of her husbands. 3 out of 4. A sneaky little bit of me sort of admires that.
Well, not just 75% of her husbands. When you look at the total death toll in her life, it was getting on for 14, 17. Some have even said it was as high as 21 victims.
These are extraordinary crimes. We have serial killers. We have a mother murdering her own children. We have Hannah Mary Tabbs chopping up her own lover. What kind of a reaction did they get, Roz, from the press at the time?
Well, the 19th century public in Britain and America loved a good sensation, and their addiction to sensational tales was really fueled by the rise of the press in this period. Now, the press is key to all these cases.
Here it is, the old story. The gay young widow of Balham, a life of dissipation, folly and vice. Just one panic.
The 19th century is the age of the newspaper, and this is because of a number of important technological developments. So new printing technology and also the falling costs of paper manufacture, which made printing news much cheaper, much quicker, and also in much larger quantities than ever before. Audiences were ready for these newspapers as well. Levels of literacy were rising. In Britain, we had the repeal of the stamp tax. This meant that newspapers were able to drop their prices to a penny and become available pretty much to all. We had national press, local press, respectable press, sensational press, newspapers with political leanings, newspapers for specific audiences, for women, for the working classes, etc. Now, all these newspapers aimed to inform and also to entertain. And they drew upon the sensational publications of old, those traditions, as well as a kind of contemporary taste for melodrama, sensation novels. And Victorians on both sides of the Atlantic loved a good murder to read about and to contemplate.
So there was a correlation between a good murder, or what the printers called a stunning good murder, and good sales of your particular paper. Do you think it had the effect on society that the coming of social media has done in our own lifetimes, Roz?
That's a really interesting parallel. And certainly what we see in murder cases such as these is a kind of relentless press coverage. And this is really facilitated by daily newspapers. Remember, they are printing pretty much what happened in the courtroom or in inquests, line by line. And this creates an extension of the courtroom into kitchens, into drawing rooms, into public houses, into gentlemen's clubs. Courts at this time were meant to be open to the public. Now, when you had such great public interest in these cases, it's not possible to get everyone into the courtroom. What the newspapers did was they took the courtroom to the people.
That's why we're studying these crimes, really, isn't it? Because the technology of the time amplified the voices of the people who were involved. That's why we can sometimes get this insight into the motive of a woman standing in the dock. That's why we're here today. I love this. It's brilliant. Now, do you think that the papers were doing more than just reporting on what went on? They were editorialising too. They were giving opinions on top of reporting the facts, weren't they?
Of course they were, because they had to describe what was going on in the courtroom as well as report it. So alongside all that verbatim transcript, you also had the descriptions of the key players, the witnesses, the defendant.
Yeah, just listen to this reporter who is stumped when Lizzie Borden receives her verdict of not guilty, and she just doesn't act like he expected she would.
If she were an ordinary woman, she would have cried and cried, perhaps fainted, then smiled and, in effective pose, reasserted the habitudes of her sex. The difficulty is, she is not an ordinary woman. She is a puzzle psychologic.
What were the tricks that these newspaper editors used to suck people into their stories, Roz?
Well, one good trick was headlines. If we look at newspapers from the early 19th century, there aren't many headlines. Newspapers came with stock sections that news was fitted under. So you had parliamentary intelligence, foreign intelligence, court news. What happened over the course of the century is that newspaper editors realised that if they constructed sensational headlines for particular crimes, particular murders, they could suck more people in. So instead of storing the reporting on a really juicy murder under court news or under local intelligence, if they pulled it out and put a gory headline with it, that would attract the attention of the public and they would buy the newspaper.
You're basically talking about clickbait, aren't you?
I am absolutely talking about clickbait, Lucy.
Let's have a look at the headlines written for some of our murderesses, or alleged murderesses. Florence Bravo, for example, becomes the gay young widow of Balham. What about Amelia Dyer?
Oh, Amelia Dyer is the child murderer of Reading.
That's chilling. And Madeleine Smith's case becomes the Glasgow poisoning.
Yes, I mean, these are quite tame, relatively, compared with a lot of others I have seen, which employ words like shocking and terrible and the rest of it. But it is quite interesting the way they try to pick out the key elements of the case. Who was the victim? What method of killing has been used, poisoning, for example, and also location. The Victorians love their geography.
When you say who is the victim, I'm very intrigued, by the way, in the Dyer case. I'd think that the mothers of the babies would be the victim, but no, they come in for some quite harsh treatment from journalists, don't they?
Some newspapers were quite quick to point their fingers at the mothers who gave away their babies to Dyer, to say that they really should bear some of the responsibility.
For the really awful circumstance in this and all other baby farming cases is less the callous cruelty of the baby farmer than the more cruel and callous-heartedness of the parents, who fling away their offspring to endure any fate that may await them at a mercenary stranger's hands. Nature dictates that mothers shall have the greater personal responsibility, and the father the larger share of the pecuniary responsibility.
Talk about victim blaming. That's extraordinary. Who is complicit in the murder of the infant? Well, the woman using the services of the childcare. My goodness, it's awful.
Esther Lack's case is really interesting as well.
This is a case that's just so troubling to think about because she was seriously ill. And her defence was insanity. What did people make of that?
Yes, that's interesting. It kind of divided the press in a way. In some quarters, there was sympathy. I mean, and we feel very sympathetic towards Esther Lack looking back on her case now. But other newspapers questioned her plea of insanity as it came after a number of women had pleaded insanity after killing their children. They wondered if this was becoming just a convenient excuse for women and if they were getting away with it.
Pall Mall Gazette, 25th of August, 1865. The legal question is not whether such persons as Esther Lack are the victims of a homicidal frenzy of the nature of madness, but whether they can be so influenced by the dread of punishment as to be deterred from the actual murderous deed. In the common interest, it is our aim to haunt their poor unhappy minds with hideous thoughts of the gallows or some other terrible vision, which will rise before their imaginations and crush the bloody impulses of disease.
Historians have shown that in the Victorian period in Britain, more than twice as many women as men were found not guilty by reason of insanity. And this has led the historian Martin Wiener, for example, to suggest that men who murdered were considered bad, while women who murdered were considered mad.
And I can see why people would use a defence of insanity. For example, when we asked Alex Wilson, our barrister, how she would defend killer Mary Ann Cotton, if she were defending her today, a mental health assessment would be the obvious step.
It would be the first thing that I'd be recommending. I think that in a case like this, where there doesn't appear to be any obvious motive when you first look at the case, you would be asking whether or not she did have any difficulties, whether she had any mental illness, whether perhaps she was even deemed insane at that time.
I love the way Alex makes it really clear that insanity is defined by society. It's not a fixed thing over time. It's something that changes according to expectation, isn't it? And our idea about mental health is very different to the Victorian one. When we spoke to Dr. Gwen Adshead, the forensic psychiatrist, she was very interesting in challenging people's sort of stereotypical view of Victorian mental health as, can I summarise it, as lock them up in an asylum and throw away the key.
I think that long-term residential care for the mentally unwell really takes off in the 19th century. I think that those ideas of physical therapy, absolutely, occupational therapy, absolutely, these are live therapies that we practice now. What I think is interesting is that we don't now give people the physical space that we used to. The big asylums that were built in the 19th century really focused on lots of space, gardens, trees, kitchen gardens, places to work. Nowadays, most secure services don't have anything like that. They're often placed in urban areas, poorer parts of town, because nobody wants a secure service, you know, near their house.
I was so surprised to hear somebody speaking up for the Victorian asylum, you know, as a place that was generously appointed, surrounded by grounds. They get such a kicking in contemporary popular culture, don't they? But there's a really senior psychiatrist saying there was something to admire here.
Historians recently have done a good job of, rehabilitating the asylum for getting underneath the bonnet and trying to pull out what asylums were actually like against the kind of gothicisation of the Victorian asylum and mental health care.
That comes from novels, doesn't it? Not from real life. Gothic novels in particular. And when Esther Lack gets sent to the Salisbury Asylum, Fisherton House, her treatment there sounds compassionate, humane, really not at all bad. Roz, would you agree?
Yes, they did have good facilities. We heard about the ballroom, for example, the extensive grounds and the more kind of domestic environment in which these women were placed.
Another thing I found really intriguing about talking to Gwen was her decision to become a forensic psychiatrist rather than an ordinary one, because she was much more comfortable dealing with people who society had already decided were criminals, rather than being in the position of judging herself if somebody was sick or if somebody was well. And you can see how the edges of illness change and are shaped as society develops. And the gatekeeper of that is the expert. There's a huge figure in the Victorian courtroom, isn't he?
Yes, he is correct. And it's interesting because we've been talking about Lack, who was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Amelia Dyer attempted this defence as well, and it went the other way for her. And it was very interesting in her case because they brought very eminent psychiatrists to the courtroom to have a debate on her mental state. In Esther Lack's case, they just brought the local doctor.
And another form of expert who became the sort of hero of the courtroom was the toxicologist, right? We spoke last time about the fascination the Victorians have with poison, the poison scare, this epidemic of poisoning that was supposed to be taking place. The toxicologist is the person who can answer that question, right?
That's right. And it's from about the 1830s that toxicology really takes off and poisoning is properly identified in victims in their bodies.
If you were reading in your Victorian newspaper about these new expert psychiatrists and toxicologists and analytical chemists and even the new professional detectives on the police force, Ross, you must have felt you were living in a wonderful, progressive, modern age.
Yes, I think to some extent, but there's always kind of light and shade in these things, isn't there? Social reform was not just about making people's lives better. It was also about discipline, social discipline. It's progress that happens at quite a gradual pace. And it's that focus on individuals, individual responsibility, self-help that works in such a way as to protect the establishment.
It was about making people's lives better without rocking the boat too much. There is progress in the Victorian age, but it's very slowly and it's with the permission of the establishment. They don't want to change too much too fast because then you might get a revolution.
There might well have been. That's what they were afraid of. They are not socialists. That's the thing. You know, if you look at the extension of the suffrage and how it comes about, these guys in the Victorian period, they are not socialists.
So if our murderesses, if our lady killers were alive today, I wonder how much they'd find familiar or different about the world in which we live. Certainly some things have changed. When we spoke to Chief Inspector Jackie Moulton, our former Met detective, she had some very amusingly encouraging tales to tell about the role of women in crime.
There are female crime bosses smashing through that glass ceiling because you can't have it both ways, can you? So we have women having independence, working professional, et cetera, et cetera. No dependency on men whatsoever. And on the shadow side of life, the criminal side of life, it's exactly the same.
That may be true, but let's have a look at some of the motivations, the context, the framing for the murderesses that we've met and see if anything strikes a chord today. Well, Madeline Smith, how does her case remind you of contemporary society, Roz? It's certainly ringing all sorts of bells for me.
Yes, well, she was said to have killed her lover to stop him exposing the sordid details of their love affair. So it's basically a case of old-fashioned revenge porn, isn't it?
So today she would take him to the police and say, look, this guy's going to put a video of me naked on the internet. Lock him up.
That's right. Back then, I don't think she would have had the same avenue because while it was blackmail, he wasn't asking for money, was he? He was just simply asking to marry her. By rights, I think a court back then would have said that he should have shown the letters to her father.
So her father would know what was going on, how his goods were being damaged, if you like.
That's right. He was the head of the household.
Ross, while we don't have baby farmers quite like Amelia Dyer these days, childcare is still a problem, isn't it? It's still an over-expensive luxury in modern society. Wouldn't you agree?
I completely agree. Childcare, especially in Britain, is hideously expensive. There is state help, but it doesn't kick in until a child is two. So if you take maternity leave from your job, what are you meant to do between about 9 months and 2 years?
How many more hundreds of years is it going to take for society to work out who's going to pay to look after the kids? It's extraordinary. Now, what about Florence Bravo then? Today, well, she wasn't actually accused of murder at the time, but had she been, and if she were accused in a modern courtroom, I think I would suggest that she went in with a defence of coercive control. That's something that we've heard about being used successfully and rightly, isn't it, in recent years?
Yes, I think that's one of the great achievements in the last decade or so, the recognition of coercive control as a defence in domestic violence and murder cases.
And she was vulnerable to this husband going after her because of her money.
He thought he was going to get it all. She had tied it all up in trusts, and he kind of found out too late, didn't he? And there was all that argument just before they got married, and I think he was hoping once they had got married that somehow he could get his hands on the goods, and of course it didn't work for him. Mm.
And if Florence were alive today and she and Charles Bravo were to get divorced, I guess would he be entitled to half of her cash?
No, because I think that Florence Bravo actually had the Victorian equivalent of a prenup. She had tied her assets up in trust before she married Charles Bravo. Quite a forward-thinking thing to do.
And for Hannah Mary Tabbs, the kind of racism, racial prejudice we saw coming to the fore, that's a big feature of contemporary society too, obviously, isn't it, Roz?
Yes. I mean, take, for example, the case of Breonna Taylor. Breonna certainly wasn't a murderer like Tabbs, but she died because of her colour. The Black Lives Matter movement would not have been out of place in 19th century America.
Let's think for a bit about the relationship between women and money. Often unhealthy to this day. Mary Ann Cotton is somebody who was motivated by economic ambition. She tried to make the best of herself because that's what a capitalist society told her that she should do. She actually took things to an extreme, which we cannot condone. If it hadn't been for the killing of people, she'd be a role model. She was a grafter. She made of herself what she could. She went for the promotion every time. She embodies Victorian values in a really dark way. But these values still hold true, don't they, Roz?
Well, would she be so out of place today?
I don't think so. Now, Grace Marks, she was a servant in 19th century Canada. This feels like a world away from our lives. But do you see any modern echoes in her story, Roz?
I do, actually. This is a young woman who goes into a workplace that is essentially toxic. Her line manager is having an affair with a boss. All the hierarchies and appropriate behaviour, it's all gone out the window, hasn't it?
And she has to live at work too. She's a live-in servant, so it's like becoming part of a really dysfunctional workplace family. Core. We've all got tales to tell about that sort of thing. I think that Esther Lack was probably the saddest of all the cases that we've looked at. It was complicated by poverty and by mental ill health, but it seems to me that she lived in a society that did not support her with the business of being a mother.
That's right. And I think we have made great strides today in supporting new mums. But to be honest, any new mum will tell you about the pressures that they feel when they become a mother. And there are still desperate cases of new mothers who take their own lives or their babies' lives even.
Today we like to feel we're somehow better than the Victorians, don't we? But, you know, this issue of helping mothers to have lives that are equal and easy still certainly hasn't been solved. And Lizzie Borden, what was the nature of her problem, Roz?
Yeah, well, as a single woman, she was just absolutely reliant on her father financially. And so when her stepmother enters a frame and starts spending that inheritance, well, she perhaps thought that killing them both was the only answer.
So she is motivated by money. Here's something, at least something that's positive. Today, Lizzie Borden would just go out and get a job.
I'd like to think so.
Well, Roz and I would like to thank everybody who's listened to this whole series. We'd like to thank our guest experts. And I would like to thank you, Roz.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Lucy, to join you on this journey of discovery.
Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Alex Baxter. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The music's composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello there. I hope you've enjoyed that episode of Lady Killers. I'm Greg Jenner. I'm a public historian, and I wanted to tell you about my BBC Radio 4 series, You're Dead to Me. It's a comedy show that takes history seriously. We explore a wide range of historical topics, and in each episode, I'm joined by a top historian and a top comedian, so we can laugh and learn about the past at the same time. We've had some brilliant guests on, including Stephen Fry. So if that sounds like something you'd like to be part of, then just search for You're Dead to Me on BBC Sounds.